Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, the very first Italian-American podcast and the home of your Italian-American moment at ItalianAmericanLife.com. I'm your proud host, Frankie D, and I'm very proud to introduce my guest, a legend in the entertainment industry and the pride of Harvey, Illinois, and the author of Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra, Mr. Tom Dreesen. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Frank. Do they call you Cheech? Do your friends call you Cheech?
Well, it's funny you say that. I was named after my grandfather, Francesco, a Sicilian, and he was called Cheecho. And yeah, a little bit.
Everybody I know named Frank, we always call Cheech.
You know, absolutely. Yes.
And still do. You know, still do.
Well, it's an honor to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank. What part of Sicily were your ancestors from?
So my mom is Sicilian, and they come from a small town called Sant'Ambrogio. And it's about 4 kilometers outside of Cefalù.
Oh, okay.
Right on the water, about maybe 40 minutes. It would be east of Palermo. On the coast.
Yeah, my people came from Palermo and from Trapani.
And Trapani, okay.
In Palermo. Yeah, I think the grandfather came from Trapani, from Palermo, and the grandmother, I think, came from Trapani.
And but so anyhow, you're talking about it. Did you ever go there?
No, I didn't, and it breaks my heart. I got to go someday. I really do. Yeah.
I highly advise you going a trip to Sicily. Have you been to Italy?
No, I have not at all in my whole life. You know, and I, you know, I'm constantly on the road and traveling through the years, and I keep thinking, I got to go there, and I'm going to try to make some time. When this COVID thing ends, there's a lot of things I think I want to do, you know.
Yes, all of us, but definitely, that's number one on your priority list. You have to go to Italy, and go to Sicily. Go to Sicily for sure. Go to Rome and then go to Sicily.
I'll tell you an interesting story, and it probably would be, you probably were going to get to it anyhow, about my being Italian. You know, they say your name is Dreesen. Well, you're not Dreesen, but that was, Walter Dreesen was my father. I find out when I'm growing up that I look just like my mom's brother-in-law, Frank Polizzi, and I look like his sons. And I had 8 brothers and sisters, and I didn't look like them. They were fair-haired for the most part. But I was a shoeshine boy. I shined shoes in all the taverns in my neighborhood. And my last tavern I'd go to would be Polizzi's Tavern, because my mother was a bartender there. And my mom's sister, my aunt, they worked in the bar. But then Frank Polizzi owned the bar. And he was my uncle, my mom's brother-in-law. And I was so fascinated by him because he told jokes behind the bar. And he had a band called Frank Polizzi and the Venetian Ears. He sang in the band. But he would tell jokes behind the bar. And I was just fascinated. He was my favorite uncle, obviously. And I was fascinated that he could do dialects and everything. And I was fascinated that with his vocabulary and his inflection and his timing, he could make the whole bar like this sound come out of their mouths, this laughter, and fill the air like electricity and unite everybody. And it fascinated me. And I used to emulate him and tell his jokes, many that should not be told on a Catholic school playground, you know. But nonetheless, as I'm growing up, I love this guy, and he always was fond of me. And then when I get to the age where I'm realizing where babies come from, I kept thinking I look so much like his sons, my cousins, and I didn't look like my brother and sister, and I looked like him. And oftentimes, wherever I'd go, people would say, "Hey, Polizzi, hey, Polizzi." I'd say, "Oh, my name isn't Polizzi. My name is Dreesen. Frank Polizzi's my uncle." They'd go, oh, I," and they thought somehow there was a blood connection there, you know. Now, when I start thinking these thoughts about my mom and my uncle, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm a young Catholic boy, I'm an altar boy. These are like impure thoughts. I just start realizing where babies came from. I didn't want to think my mom and dad did this, let alone my mom and her brother-in-law, you know. So anyhow, and he was a tough Sicilian, by the way. He took no guff from nobody, no time, no place. I saw him throw Teamsters out of his bar 2 at a time, guys that worked in the factories, if they used foul language and stuff like that. And another story that I'm going long here, Frank, forgive me, but I'll tell you.
No, this is very interesting.
Okay. I'll digress. To show you how tough he was. In those days in all the bars, you know, they never called it the mafia. They called it the syndicate. The syndicate installed any vending machines in your bar, cigarette machines or jukeboxes. So he worked in a factory for years and saved enough money to buy this bar. And he bought an old wooden jukebox that had 78 records in it and a Wurlitzer jukebox. And I think he paid like $80 or $100 for that old jukebox. and he bought the records that go in there. Now, he's only open a couple of weeks when a truck pulls up in front, and they bring out this big, beautiful, gorgeous jukebox, and they wheel it in, these two big guys, and my mom and my aunt were behind the bar, and I was sitting over in a corner, and my uncle was in the back. Frank Peluzzi was in the back having lunch. And they bring in the jukebox, and they said, Mrs. Peluzzi, sign here. And my aunt said, gee, I don't know what you're talking about. They said, we're delivering the jukebox. She said, let me call my husband. And Frank comes out, and he, you know, my uncle, he's wiping his hands off. He's just having some pasta in the kitchen, you know, in the back of the bar. And he says, what's going on, fellas? They said, Mr. Peluzzi, sign here. The jukebox was sent over by Babe Tuffinelli, you know, the guy who was the main guy in that area. He was from Blue Island. I was from Harvey, but we were from Harvey, but. And, you know, Frank said, I didn't order that. They said, Mr. Peluzzi, you don't order jukeboxes. We install them in every place. He said, I didn't order it. Get it out of here. They said, Mr. Peluzzi, our job is to deliver it. We're walking out of here. He said, get that jukebox out of here. I didn't order it. And they wouldn't do it. He puts it on a two-wheeler. He wheels it outside, and he went to put it by the truck, and it fell over and broke on the sidewalk. Now, my mom and my aunt, they start singing the rosary, you know, at that time, you know.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. And about half an hour later, a car pulls up in front, you hear the brakes, slam, doors open up, two big guys and this other guy get out of the car. This is a guy named Babe Tuffinelli. This is in my book, by the way, you know. But anyhow, he comes in and said, hey, you broke my jukebox. You broke my jukebox. And my uncle said, I told your goons to get it out of here because he didn't like mafia at all. Of course, they didn't call it mafia in those days. He didn't like those guys, you know. So now they're arguing back and forth and sometimes in a little bit of dialect, Sicilian dialect, and they're going back and forth. But he held his ground. He said, I worked in a factory for years to save my money to buy this place. And then he said something to the effect like, go muscle the metagons. Don't muscle me, you know. And as you know, for those who are listening who do not know what a metagon, our old Italian ancestors could not say American. So they say, he's a metagon, you know, that was their way of saying. So it wasn't a derogatory term. It just meant a non-Italian, you know. So he said, you know, go muscle the metagons. Don't muscle me. You know, and so finally the guy, it was interesting, Babe Tuffinelli said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you keep your jukebox. But if you ever leave this business, I'd like it if you'd come and work for me. And he said, I'd never work for the likes of you. He didn't believe in syndicate mafia people. Anyhow, long story short, that's how tough he is. Now, I've seen him, this tough guy, and I like him so much. And now I'm going to confront him one day. And it's in the book. I go to him and I say, I need to talk to you. And we took a walk and he said, what's on your mind? I said, I think you're my biological father. And he said, what makes you think that? I said, because I don't look like my brothers and sisters. And I look just like Don and Buzz. That was his son's, you know, nickname Buzz. But I said, I'm just like Don and Buzz. He said, he walked a little bit further. And I said, and everywhere I go, people call me Peluzzi. You know, and I keep telling them I'm a Greason.
How old were you at this time?
I was 13.
13?
And you had almost 14.
This idea at 13 years old.
I was almost 14, you know, but it all started making sense to me, you know, and I'm going to digress from there. There was an Italian carnival in Blue Island near where I lived. I lived in Harvey, St. Donatus. And every year I went there, they had all the booths and the food and the smells and the sound and the music, you know, and I always felt like I belonged there, you know, bum, ba, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum, you know, and the smells. And I, you know, so I think there's something to this DNA that I felt this affinity to him. And then I also felt like I belonged there, you know. Anyhow, he took a couple of steps and he said, okay, he said, you're right. And you can go now and tell the world it would ruin your mom and dad's marriage and it would ruin mine, but you have the right to know that. And I said, I don't want to ruin anybody's marriage. I just wanted to know. And I'm just a kid. Now, after that, I felt like I wasn't, I felt kind of uncomfortable around him, you know, and because I was young. And then, you know, I'd say hello and all that, and I still loved the guy, but I was a little bit uneasy around him. Then I went in the Navy when I was 17, and when I came home on leave, by that time I'm a mature, I'm growing up, and I didn't care who planted the seed. You know, Walter Dreesen will always be my father, but Frank Peluzzi was my biological father, and we had a closeness, and we kept it till the day he died. And I kept it a secret all those years, you know, but on his deathbed, and I'm going to end up the Sicilian story, but on his deathbed, he said to me, he was laying on his deathbed, he's in the hospital. He said, I need to know, do you have any regrets about our situation, you and me? I said, no, I don't. He said, Tom, just because I'm laying here dying, get it off your chest. If there's anything you want to say, he said, I said, no, there's nothing. I have no regrets. I said, in fact, everything I am, everything that I've accomplished, because I came from your genes. So I have no regrets. But do you have any regrets? And he said, the only regrets I have is that every time I see you on TV, if I'm in a bar with my buddies or anywhere, I cannot say to them, that's my boy, that's my kid. He said, I could never say that. And I said, well, and he's a tough guy, by the way. And I said, well, one day I'm going to, because he had the band and, you know, I said, you, I emulated you. That's how I became a comedian. I said, one day I'll receive an award in our business and I'll accept it in your name. And he got choked up. He looked away because I never saw him cry. He got tears in his eyes. Now, years later, I am on Ellis Island. I'm the master of ceremonies of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor Awards. And I received that award for humanitarian services. And I accepted it in his name. I told everybody in this 2,000 people in the audience, I said, my biological father came here on the SS Italia from Sicily when he was 7 years old. And I accept this in his name, Frank Polizzi, you know. So that was a full circle thing coming around. So now that's out of the way. So
I wow. Just, wow, that had to be though a lot to take in as a 13-year-old boy, and then not be able to say anything and have to live with it. That was a lot. That had to be a real lot.
The thing that I felt bad about was Walter Dreesen was an alcoholic, and he was a good man, a docile man. He was very calm. He was not like Frank Polizzi, who would fight at the drop of a hat, you know. And my Walter Polizzi played in a band, Frank Polizzi's band, Frank Polizzi and the Venetianeers. My dad played trumpet, you know. And he was just a weak guy, and he became an alcoholic. All beer, that's all he ever drank. But I felt bad for him. I would see him and think, does he know? And how could he not look at me and look at my cousins and not see that? And it gave me a great admiration from years later that him and my mom would get in these big arguments, and never once did he bring it up. So if he did know, it was kind of a confusing thing, because he's always going to be, when you're raised with eight brothers and sisters, I don't care if you're in an orphanage, they're your brothers and sisters, you know. And he's my dad. Frank Polizzi was my biological father, but so be it. And by the way, I love them both.
Sure. So no, very, very interesting. I have to tell you, the book, what a real easy read, if you understand what I'm saying. Like, it flowed well. It was an easy read. It was very interesting. And this may sound insane, but when I was reading it, I could hear your voice. It was like you were narrating this story as I was reading the book.
I really appreciate that, Frank, because more than once I've heard that people who know me personally and said, you know what, I felt like we were sitting in a restaurant or in a bar hanging out, and you were telling these stories. They felt the same way. And I'm glad the book read that way to you, because that's what I wanted. You know, I wanted to make sure that everything I said in that book, I had two guys help me with the narration, but I said, I want every word to be mine and every story to be mine, because I would never want anybody to say, I read your book and you said something, and I say, no, I didn't say that. Well, that's stupid. If you wrote the book, you said it. So I'm glad that you felt that's what I wanted it to be like.
Absolutely. And unfortunately for me, I'm not a real fast reader. And if things don't interest me, it's a struggle to read. And this was one of those books where it was a pleasure, and it went smooth, and it went easy, and it went fast, relatively fast for me. So congratulations on the book. It was a very, very well-written book.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, June. I mean, I can't tell you how pleased I am. Amazon, they've got over 100 reviews now, 5-star reviews. And so I'm thrilled with the way people are responding to it, you know.
That's great. And I'm curious, what made you write a book at this point in your life?
You know what, Frank, all my career, whenever I from shining shoes in bars, you know, when I was a little boy, 8 years old, to my life now, whenever something interesting happened or funny, I would retain it in my brain. As years go by, I began to journal things. Every time something funny or poignant would happen, I would write it down. And especially when I first started making and struggling in show business, Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team. History shows we were the last. From 1969 to 1975, we toured the nation as the first black and white comedy team. And there were no comedy clubs in those days. So we worked all black clubs in the North and the South, and all white nightclubs too, you know, like we were the Playboy Circuit and stuff like that. Even the Playboy Club was integrated in those days. But the things that happened to us in those days, I would go back to the room sometimes and write it down. Because again, we were an anomaly. You know, we were, nobody had ever seen anybody like us. And we attacked material. We broke every racial stereotype. Today, the politically correct police would run us out of town on a rail. but so I record them. Then when I start, when the team split up and I start doing the Johnny Carson show and the Tonight Show and all those things, and then touring with Sammy Davis Jr. and touring with Smokey Robinson and touring Gladys Knight and the Pips and Natalie Cole and Tony Orlando and Dawn and James Nairn and Frankie Avalon and all these guys. When I start touring with all these people, I would, every time something funny or poignant would happen, I'd go back to the room and journal. And then when I start touring with Sinatra, that opened a whole new world to me. And now I'm performing at the White House and I'm performing in front of 20,000 people and 40,000 in Hawaii, you know, all around. All these things were fascinating to me that I would go back to the room and journal it and say, maybe one day I would like to write a book about all these things. But I always viewed it from that little boy. And Frank, this is not BS. To this day, no matter what I'm doing, no matter where I'm at, no matter what wonderful things have happened to me in my life, if I close my eyes, I see a little boy with a shoeshine box trudging through the snow, going from bar to bar, on his hands and knees, trying to make money to feed his brothers and sisters. And that's the way I perceive these, from that boy's, little boy's eyes. That was the way I wrote the book. And you know, and I always tell everybody, the book is about that little boy on his hands and knees, shining shoes and bars, hearing Frank Sinatra on the jukebox. And one day that little boy is carrying Frank Sinatra's coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills, California. So that's the journey that I take the audience on. As you know, you read the book.
Definitely, that's what I took from it. I felt that you're very humble about your success and you never forgot where you came from, which is a very important trait.
I don't think you could grow up as poor as we did, you know, 8 kids living in a shack, never knowing if you're going to have a meal sometimes. I don't think you can grow up that poor and not forget where you came from. You know what I'm saying? Anthony Quinn once said something that I never forgot. He said, and because he grew up raggedy poor like we did, but he said, if you were ever hungry as a child, really, truly hungry, and you didn't know if you were going to eat again, that hunger that was in your stomach never leaves your subconscious mind. And I identify with that statement, because you can't grow up the way I grew up and my brothers and sisters grew up, that you could forget where you came from, you know. I don't think any of them.
For sure, for sure. If you didn't mind, a real quick Frank Sinatra story. I know you have 1,000 of them, but just a real quick one, I think would be extremely interesting.
Well, you're right. I got 1,000 of them. I do a one-man show, a 90-minute show called An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra, or sometimes I call it The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh. And in there, I do stand-up comedy, of course. The theater goes dark and the screen comes on, and Dennis Farina, God rest his soul, my dear friend, narrates my life, 3.5 minutes of my life. Then I come out and do stand-up comedy, but I go to a bar after about 30 minutes and there's a bottle of Jack Daniels on the bar, and I segue over there and I tell a funny story at the bar, and all the lights go out and Sinatra is singing, Frank is singing to the audience. It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So I let that mood set in. It's a saloon song. And then
I think I have the album to that, literally the album. My parents bought a lot of records from Columbia Records. And I kept them in the wee small hours and all that.
I love all the stuff. And so anyhow, and then what I do is I take the audience on a journey of this little boy and his experience, and I tell many funny stories. But there's a poignant story that I tell that's in the book. It exemplifies what Frank Sinatra was really all about. He was first like the boss of the tour, because he was the boss of the tour when I toured with him in 14 years and 45, 50 cities a year. But he later became a buddy, a pal. And then he later, toward the end of his life, was more like a father to me. But so he taught me a lot of things. But one of the lessons he taught me, we were leaving the Waldorf Astoria one night in New York. He was going out the back door because he couldn't go out the front. He'd get mobbed. We were rushing to the limo to go to a gig. And as we were running out the door, a woman, the doorman told me she'd been hiding in the doorway in the back for like 5 hours. She started screaming, Mr. Sinatra, please, Mr. Sinatra, please, please. And Frank was getting in the limo and she kept hollering, please. And security was holding the woman back. And he got out of the limo and he went back to her and he said, what is it? And she said, Mr. Sinatra, please, my husband is home very ill, very, very ill. And if I could get an autograph from you, it would mean the world to him. He said, sure. And he's signing the autograph. And she said, oh, what beautiful cufflinks. And they were very, very expensive cufflinks, over $1,000. I know where he got them at. But she said, oh, what beautiful cufflinks, as he was signing the autograph. He said, thank you. And he finished the autograph and he took the cufflinks off and he handed them to her and said, give these to your husband. She said, oh, no. I don't. I was just admiring them. He said, no, I want you to have them. Give them to your husband. Now we get in the limo and I said, Frank, that was beautiful. But why did you do that? He said, Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, then you don't possess it. It possesses you. And I thought, whoa, that was pretty profound.
That is profound.
Yeah. He said, Tommy, nothing we have is ours. He said, Aristotle Onassis, this multi-billionaire, the second he died, everything transferred. All of his yachts, his private jets, his mansions, everything he had, the second he died, transferred. They weren't really his. He was only using them. Nothing we have is ours. I never forgot that lesson. And I'll tell you something funny. About 2 weeks later, it's kind of an Italian story too. 2 weeks later, the Minnesota Vikings were playing the Chicago Bears out here. And I mean, they were playing on TV. It was Monday Night Football. And all my Goombas, you know, Frankie Avalon and James Nairn and Joe Pesci and Dennis Farina and Dennis France and Joe Mantegna, Frankie Valli, they all came over. And Dennis Farina was making pasta and Frankie Avalon was making Philadelphia cheesesteaks. And I mean, we were all going to, you know. And the reason why I had Eddie Marinaro come over, so he used to play for the Minnesota Vikings. And so I'm running over to the liquor store. This is about 2 weeks after Frank told me that story. And I'm going to get some beer and pop and stuff. And as I was in the liquor store, I had on an NBC golf hat and an NBC golf shirt. I had just played in Lake Tahoe in their tournament. So I had it on a day I was playing golf. And I'm running, and I run in the store and I got some beer and some pop and some stuff. And as I'm paying for it, the guy behind the counter had an accent, like an Arabic accent or something. He said, hey, boss, I like your hat. Nice hat, boss. It said NBC Sports on it, you know, like your hat, boss. He said, could I have your hat? And I said, no, it matches my shirt here, you know, and I paid for it. And I go out to the car and I thought what I just said. I went back inside. He had another customer and I set the hat down on the counter. And as I was leaving, he's saying, hey, boss, I'm only joking. Only joking, boss. I said, no, I want you to have the hat. The thought that a hat possessed me, that I thought of what Frank had told me, that you mean to tell me that in all of your living and all of the wonderful things happened to you, a hat owned you?
I know that's words to live by.
That has profoundly changed my life more than you'll ever know.
Wow, that's extremely interesting. I mean, that's great stuff. There was one story at the end that I actually folded the page over. A little story about you going to the Cubs game with the nuns. Apparently, you were an altar boy, and they would take some of the kids to the Cubs game. So, if I could just read it real quick. It says, you remember attending several games with the nuns. One game, while in the company of the nuns, there were two guys sitting behind us who couldn't see the game over the nuns' habits. One guy said loudly enough so the nuns could hear him, I'm going to go to Texas. Only 15% of the population there is Catholic. And the other guy said, yeah, well, I'm going to go to Oklahoma. Only 10% of the population down there is Catholic. At which point, one of the nuns turned around and said sharply, without irony, why don't you go to hell? There are no Catholics down there. that just killed me, that story. That's a true story, huh?
That's a story I told in my act. It's an apocryphal story. I told in my act and it always got a big laugh. And the nuns liked it more than anybody. The nuns used to just crack up over that story, you know. I went to Catholic school. I can tell you my nuns, you know, off the top of my head, Sister Catherine Margaret, Sister Margarita, Sister Bernadette Marie, Sister Marie Andre, Sister Anne Cecile, Sister Bertilda, Sister Thomasita, and Sister Madonna Treese. I'll put those eight nuns up against any SWAT team Chicago.
Yes, they were tough back then. But you know what? It was great because they had such a profound effect on you.
They were great teachers. You send your children to school to be taught. You know, the nuns, and that's what's wrong with our school system today. The nuns would say, we came here to teach and you came here to learn. If you interfere with that process, you're out of here. And the worst thing you could do is, you know, you go back home and you tell your mother, sister hit me with a ruler today. You know what she said? Well, what did you do? She didn't say, let me go to school and hit sister. You know, today they would have sister put in jail.
Exactly.
You
know,
but they came to teach and you came to learn. When I left Catholic school and went to a public high school, I was head and shoulders above the other kids because we were learning algebra in third and fourth grade. You know, the nuns were just great teachers. And I say some of them were strict, but some of them were the sweetest women I've ever known. You know, I always attribute them. They taught me how to pray, Frank. And they also told me when I was a little boy growing up that I had a father in heaven. And my father wasn't much of a father. He was a good guy, but he was never there. He was in the bars all the time. He never took me fishing, hunting like other boys. He never tossed the ball at me or, you know, took me for, you know, for riding, you know, those kind of things. He never had a car, thank God, because he'd have killed somebody drinking. But the nuns said, I had a father in heaven. And they also taught us that his son came down here and died on the cross. But he came to tell you about the Father in heaven. And they taught us the prayer about the Father in heaven, you know, the Lord's Prayer. And as a little boy in first grade, I kept thinking, I got a Father in heaven. And I began to pray to that Father in heaven. And I do to this day. There's not a night that I don't go to bed that before I go to bed, I get on my hands and knees and I pray for people who are ill and stuff. But I pray in gratitude. Thank you, Father, for where I'm at. What you took me through. There were times I left my father many times, but he never left me. And that's the power of prayer. And I'll tell you a quick story. In September 1969, I went on stage for my very first time with Tim Reed. Something I had written got a laugh. And it was like a dark clouds opening up, like a B movie, like an epiphany. And I knew at that moment what I wanted to be. I'd been wandering aimlessly all that time. I knew I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. My whole being went, oh, yes. When I got a laugh with something I had written, I said, oh, yes, now I know what I want to be. I couldn't sleep that whole night. I got up Saturday morning, and there was no service. I went down to Ascension Church in Harvey, where I'd been an altar boy, excuse me, where I sang in the choir when I was a little boy, where my mom sang in a choir when she was a little girl. And there was no service there, no one in church. I got on my knees and I prayed. I said, God, I now know what I want. I want to be a stand-up comedian. If you would let me make my living as a comedian, I'll never ask for anything more. I'll do charity work. I made a lot of promises. And for 51 years, I've made my living as a stand-up comedian. God kept his promise and I kept mine, you know. But I was, that was September 1969. In September 2019, 50 years to the day, I went back to that church and I spoke Sunday at a Sunday mass. I gave the sermon on the power of prayer. And I told the audience, it's not psychic hocus pocus that I believe in prayer. It's common sense. I said, how many of you out there, raise your hand, how many of you out there, if you were thinking of somebody, hadn't seen them in a long time, and then the phone rings and it's that person. How many of you out there has that happened? How many times have you thought about someone you haven't seen in years, and you're walking down the street and turn the corner, and lo and behold, that's that person you were thinking about. And you say, I was just thinking about you. And they say, you know, I was thinking about you too. How many times that happened? The whole congregation raised their hand. I said, if we humans can transfer thought, and we can, we just proved it, then how much could a supreme being, someone who created the universe, you think they can hear our thoughts? That's just common sense. So that's the power of prayer.
For sure. And it's a matter of faith. And unfortunately, younger people have trouble with that, I think, nowadays, and it's sad. You have to have.
I wonder why. I wonder why younger people, because, you know, we used to say the Lord. We used to say the prayer in school every morning before we started. We'd pray in school. We'd go to church before we went to school, and they took all that out. You know, somebody said a wonderful story one time. You know, and it said it was the discussion was about abortion or something like that. But they said that this guy said to God, God, you know, if you're God, you know, why haven't you sent someone down here to find a cure to cancer or all these diseases? And God said, I sent them, you killed them.
Hmm. Yes.
Pretty profound, huh?
Very profound, yes. Yes. Well, Tom, the book, Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage in Sinatra, available on Amazon. Highly recommended to all. Great read. You are you're a great man. I really like everything about what I read in the book, and what was in the book is you, and it comes across. I feel like I've known you for 50 years myself. So thank you so much for the interview. And to everyone, my advice, buy the book, read it, you'll enjoy it. And my advice to you, if I can give you some advice, please take a trip to Italy. Take a trip to Italy. You won't remember me, but you may think, somebody told me to take this trip, and they were right.
I remember you, Frank. Viva Italia.
Viva Italia. You go to Rome, and then go down to Sicily to see where the family's from, okay?
Okay, I would love to do that. Yeah, I think I will one day. I think I'll take my nephew with me, Kerry Polizzi, who lives in Chicago. He travels with me sometimes.
He would love it.
Thanks, Frank, for the interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And to all the listeners, as I always end everything, stay proud. Thank you.